So carrying on where we left off last week with Asanga's Bodhisattva stages, practice of the Bodhisattva's three pure precepts, on the bottom of page 3. This is this long section that's the extensive commentary on the third pure precept of abundantly benefiting living beings, or embracing and sustaining living beings. That as is the case with this kind of treatise in the old days like this, the whole thing sounds sort of like a legal document, you know. It's all these different lists and sub-lists and so there's this 11 points of 11 subcategories of benefiting all beings, the third pure precept. And just to review the first ones, first is Bodhisattva renders assistance. That's like at the top of page 3. Next one, Bodhisattva teaches sentient beings with relevancy. Third is Bodhisattva seeing an occasion for showing gratitude to sentient beings, treats them with respect and gratitude. Fourth is Bodhisattva protects frightened sentient beings from fear. So far these... let's keep going. Five is the Bodhisattva relieves the sorrow of sentient beings who suffered calamity. Six is Bodhisattva provides requisites for those who want requisites. So all of these so far are all about giving, really. They're about giving material things that help people, and they're giving dharma to help people, teachings to help people, and they're giving protection from fear to protect those in danger, which are the three types of giving classically. So now we're up to, this is like the middle of the last paragraph, is the seventh type of benefiting beings, where Asanga says, furthermore, the Bodhisattva, with the ethics of gathering, performs an act of gathering by attracting a crowd of sentient beings. With no thought of self-interest, backed by only a thought of mercy, he gives himself as a resource. She subsequently seeks, in accord with the teachings, robes, food, bed and bedding, medicinal drugs, and other requisites from faithful Brahmins and householders for their sake. I think you mean there is like the crowd of people. And I think it seems to be referring to maybe gathering a sangha of practitioners and then kind of fundraising for them, for their support, to support this gathering of, this sangha gathering, you might say, in accord with the teachings, to gather these material resources, the classic list of that we all need: food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. The Buddha talked about this is what we all basically need.
So is the seventh mode the gathering, the act of
gathering. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And giving of oneself as a resource as part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that's the seventh mode?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then his own robes, food, bedding, drugs, and requisites obtained according to the teachings, he uses in common and not privately. Mm-hmm. And from time to time gives appropriate advice on various topics.
Is that
like dharma teaching? That's still all seven.
All these different variations of
gathering. So it's like, you know, does fundraising from the Brahmins to gather these things, but then one has one's own resources too and shares those too. So it's a great spirit, I think. I think of like when Shoho and I first moved into the house here at 113, previously there had been someone who wasn't really practicing with the Sangha living here. So, like at Sashin's, he'd often put like big tape X's across the cabinets, which I always thought had a little funny feeling. It's kind of like, it's practical, I know, but it's like, this is reserved. I'm not sharing these resources with the Sangha. And as I mentioned to Patrick, as a global Sangha person, when moving in, thought, well, if you know, global Sangha has its fundraising and I have my fundraising, you know, so we have these things. But if we ever need anything when cooking, and the Tenzos, I try to remember to tell the Tenzos to, in the past, if you ever run out of something in Sashin, feel free to take anything from any of the cabinets or refrigerator. Yeah, it's great, you know. And, you know, it might be, if I came in one day and everything was completely empty and gone, then I might say, oh, I don't know about this.
Too much giving.
But, you know, it's a small thing, and, you know, nobody takes so much, but to try to, in a Sangha community, to share resources. There's always more that could be done in this way, right? But and I think when it's talking about the ethics of gathering, or the precept of gathering, this may also be referring to this topic called the four Samgraha Vastu, and which is in our tradition of Dogen Zenji, called the Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance. It's one translation. This is a Shobo Genzo fascicle.
Oh, yeah, that's
yeah.
A great
yeah. Fascicle. And I think we have a class series on this later this summer, on our theme of Bodhisattva practice for this year. So, for a long time, I thought, oh, Dogen just came up with this list of four, but it's actually this traditional list that often goes along when the six paramitas are taught. Sometimes these four are taught. Like the six paramita are, I even found one commentary that said the six paramitas are the second pure precept of embracing and sustaining all good. And these four bodhisattva methods are the third pure precept of embracing and sustaining all beings. That's one way to talk about these. And so, without getting too much into it, because save it for this later class, the Samgraha Vastu. Samgraha means to gather, and Vastu means like the articles or methods, we might say. Gathering methods are these four things called giving, kind speech. I think our translation says beneficial action and identity action. But in the Indian tradition, actually a Sangha might have been the first to teach these. It might be in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, but when looking for it, I only found it in one of Asanga's writings, not this one, but another one, where accomplishing beneficial action is one way of looking at that is teaching others according to their like level of experience.
Or
it definitely gets into. So appropriately benefiting dharma-wise, but also maybe, you know, what kind of things you give to somebody according to where they're at in their life. So skillful means. But particularly the fourth, I think it's not so clear when reading Dogen and what originally this one is. This identity action is basically usually translated like consistency of behavior or practicing with what one teaches.
Walking your talk.
So identity action, Dogen gets into this non-dual thing of we're all identical. I think he plays with it like that, right? The identity of all of us. But the original meaning seems to be my practice is identical to what I would teach. Which is quite hard to do, right? But yeah, practice what we preach, right? setting a good example. So these are the ways to gather a sangha, actually, to gather a group of practitioners. Be very generous to people, and speak very kindly to people, and benefit them according to their situation, and set a good example. So it's a nice teaching. We'll look into much more later, but Asanga doesn't mention those four things here, but I couldn't help think of it when he said, with this precept of gathering, the Bodhisattva performs an act of gathering beings. Which when they translate this Samgraha Vastu into Chinese and Japanese, like in the Shobogenzo, it's Bodhisattva Shishobo or Shishoho, the four embracing and sustaining dharmas. It's the character that's used in these precepts for embrace and sustain.
Could you just break that down for me?
Bodhisattva, Bodhisattva.
There's some up here too.
Yeah, but the Dogen's Bodhisattva, Bodhisattva, Shishobo. Shi means four in this case. Uh-huh. And Shobo or Shoho in this case means the Sho is the same one here, yeah. And this one that repeats in all of them, embrace and sustain. In the parentheses, the first one in the parentheses, and ho means dharma. So it's the four embracing and sustaining dharmas, which mean embrace and sustain also means to gather. So this may be a little bit coincidental, but it's kind of neat that this keeps showing up, this character. Embracing, sustaining, gathering, holding, and that character actually, do you see it there? The first, the one that repeats at the beginning of all three, the left-hand radical, the left-hand part, is a hand. It's the character for hand, and the other three repeated. There's three little like symbols. Repeated, are like listening, hearing, ear. Yeah, so kind of like that. And the way that we embrace and sustain is we offer a hand while listening to the needs. So
I don't understand which character that is.
Is it the last character?
It's the first.
Thing in it?
See in parentheses, the parts in parentheses?
Yeah.
So the first one, first character.
Boxes,
yeah, three little ear listeners. And then the hand on the left. So, see, the first one has that at the beginning. That's the character, means embrace and sustain. The second one, I didn't put in parentheses because it's identical in Asanga and Dogen. Or Dogen's later version, we'd say. And then the third slightly shifts. The first and the second, the first and the third core precept, as we talked about, are the same meaning, but the characters slightly shift.
Wow.
The first bit, and as I mentioned before, Asanga's version is the same as Dogen's Shobogenzo Jukai fascicle. But then it seems like sometime later, after Dogen's time in Soto Zen, they kind of like decided to use the embrace and sustain character for all three. Mm-hmm. Which has some precedent. There's other texts do that too. So anyway, these four methods could also be called, the four Bodhisattva methods of guidance could be called the four embracing and sustaining methods also. So the eighth type of aspect of benefiting beings down here is, furthermore, the Bodhisattva with the ethics of mental compliance complies, or we could say accords, with the expectations of sentient beings. So, and this one's going to have a long commentary.
Yeah, problematic.
Interesting that the Bodhisattva accords with sentient beings. And I recently heard that Suzuki Roshi, when he was dying, I think like the last day of his life maybe, or the last few days, he was at the San Francisco Zen Center, and some of his close students were gathered around him, and it was sort of like maybe some of his final thoughts for his students. What I heard he said to the group was, be what people want you to be. I thought that's a profound teaching. In other words, instead of like being what you want to be, be what other people want you to be. Which is almost like a little koan, right? It's like, we could hear it as, well then that's not really being yourself, that's just like, that's maybe sounds like it could be conforming to, you know, people's wishes. But I think that's what it is, actually, right? Yeah, be what people want you to be. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to be mindful about...
And what if they want you to be something that's not really your true self? So I think we take it as a koan. We think it... What did he mean by that? Be what people want you to be. But I thought of that here. A bodhisattva accords with living beings.
Where is the accord part?
Well, this says complies. The bottom of page 3.
Okay.
With mental compliance, complies. But I think we could translate it as accords.
Part of that, I think, has to do with where the Sangha is at in its own development and seeing and sensing that and being in accord with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not pushing the Sangha because mm-hmm. you have some idea, but maybe introducing an idea mm-hmm. or whatever, but not forcing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not getting stuck in your ego. Well, this is the way I think things should be, and mm-hmm. you might be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Sangha could be off on a tangent, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's the tricky part. It's very dynamic,
right?
And as well here, you know, as part of this actual section, the Bodhisattva like admonishes
yes.
beings
yes.
too, right? That's part of according with them.
Yes.
So that's quite dynamic.
He was so completely devoted to the Sangha. He probably looked at these American followers and said, I'm not sure they're going to just like completely devote themselves to this. You know.
Suzuki Roshi. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm imagining.
Yeah, like we have this one story that, you know, in Japan it's very unusual to eat brown rice. Right? So,
wow.
it's kind of like a sort of low class thing,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Like unrefined. But this was like when Tassajara was starting, it was like, you know, the days of macrobiotics.
Yeah.
All about brown rice and
yes.
good and health food, health benefits.
Brown rice, save the world.
So Zen macrobiotics, which is like this modern thing, you know.
Yes.
And maybe in ancient times people ate brown rice, but I think for a long time in Japan it's been white rice.
Yes.
And but the Americans like brown rice because it's healthy. And so they kind of like, I don't know exactly how this went, but apparently Suzuki Roshi conformed or accorded with his students' wish for brown rice, and he talked about it some, like it's good to chew it a lot, and Zazen's like chewing brown rice, or he's got some talk about brown rice. There's one theory that might have actually like shortened his own lifespan,
really?
His own digestion. I don't know. But he really gave himself to his students, yeah. And of course, he didn't just go along with American hippie style. He also offered a whole bunch of new, different things than they were used to. It was part of according also, because they wanted that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So now the commentary on this. First, she knows the dispositions, the nature, and the elements of sentient beings. And the one commentary on that says, dispositions is the karmic tendencies of sentient beings, knows like where they're at. the nature is particularly the inclination towards these different vehicle, like small vehicle, great vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of the commentary. Is like if beings really want to do, like, I want to do really strict, you know, meditation practice, and, you know, I don't know about all this bodhisattva stuff, but I want to follow the Pali Canon teachings and the jhanas, you know, then one can say, okay, I'll help you do that, if that's your disposition, if that's your nature. And the elements is like the instinct. So basically, knowing what people are like and what they need and would like, knowing their dispositions, nature, and elements, he lives together with sentient beings as one should live with them, acting towards sentient beings as one should act toward them, in accord with what their salvation requires. I just thought of that line in the Lotus Sutra, I give voice to the various teachings. We chant that one sometimes.
You know, our initial concern that the complying with the expectations of sentient beings are that it might be, you know, we have to watch out for our boundaries.
Yes.
I think it's so interesting that now I'm sensing, and I turn the page, I see it might be true, that there's a whole lot of descriptions now of the nuance.
Yes.
Of that.
Yes.
It's not just a simplistic, oh, mm-hmm. That's what you want, oh, okay, I'll do it.
Yeah.
But the nuance, even from this first sentence.
Yes.
Really paying attention to where people are at and what there's their yep. nature, where they're at developmentally.
And what's
so
beneficial.
Response yeah. isn't just this sort of superficial response.
Yeah, yeah. He's clarifying now particularly that it's in accord, but only if it benefits. So he even says, so this is a long section. Again, this is one of these pieces that sounds like some sort of legal document because it's like, it's like a couple paragraphs making this point. That basically, in the bodhisattva desiring to comply with the expectations mm-hmm. of any sentient being sees that doing something involving body or speech will result in pain and happiness for another, in this case means that particular expectant sentient being. And the bodhisattva reflects that the pain and unhappiness will not move that person from his unwholesome to a wholesome situation. He will reject that action of body or speech conscientiously and not do it. So basically, this is a long way of saying, I think I need to do something that's going to be a little bit painful for this person. But let me check if it were to accord, and it's not in accord with their expectation. They want me to give them one thing, but I think actually I want to give another thing that's not going to make them happy. And then I like check. Will this thing that doesn't make them happy in the long run and actually bring benefit to them in the larger sense?
Yeah,
so it's all these different categories. If it doesn't, then I won't do it, and I'll just do what they want me to do. If it will actually help them to go kind of against what they're expecting, then I will do that. And then there's all the permutations, including a third party. It mentions, okay, this person really doesn't want me to give them this advice or whatever, but I think it will benefit them in the long run. But there's a third party involved in this situation that won't benefit. Mm-hmm. Actually, they'll be harmed by this. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we can't, even though I think it'll help this person, I better not do it. Mm-hmm. So it's getting very detailed. And looking at the whole picture, and we might say, well, what kind of situations are these, right?
Yeah.
So I try thinking of some, right? Yeah, I think we can think, you know.
What about the wife, you know?
Yeah, so like that. I think in Dharma teacher-student relationships, there's what come to mind for me, like basically things that the person doesn't want to hear, but that actually helps them. I think of many examples with my teacher, how I received gifts that were not in accord with my expectations for my happiness, but that actually were beneficial to me in the long run, which I came to see later. Like, I can even mention a few if you'd like.
Yeah.
One time, I left Zen Center. It was, well, actually this whole situation involved a lot of this type of thing. I had just gotten ordained as a priest, and it was a sort of unspoken agreement that, like, well, you know, stay single for a while, don't get into a relationship. And I, like, almost immediately got into a relationship. We didn't have a kind of formal agreement about this. Now, Tenzin Roshi makes these formal agreements with his priest candidates. Yeah. Yeah, I was maybe the, you know, the impetus. Yeah, ruined it. And I, you know, as a little footnote, and, you know, to the point where he would say, you actually have to stop your priest training if you get into a full-on sexual relationship during your first 5 years. And his current group, his latest group of priests, I think 4 out of the 5 of them are no longer wearing their robes for this reason. So it's happening in a kind of big way, and he's kind of sticking to it. Say, well, we'll make an exception. He actually, no. So it's amazing to me, and I don't know how he feels about that.
They've been doing what they've been doing and then coming back.
Yeah, they can come back, exactly. And there's a thing about this later here in this part about being banished and then returning. Bodhisattva precepts can involve this kind of thing. But I thought, wow, and not all at once, of course, you know, gradually 4 out of the 5 all got into relationships. So my question, is something not working with this program? That's another discussion. But anyway, he's sticking with it. So I was one of those before they had that arrangement. I left, and he said, why don't you leave for a while? And not as so much as a banishment. I mean, I could have taken it that way, but I think the spirit was, and maybe that's the spirit of what is meant by banishment here. But he said, go work on your relationship. Go establish that. It's too hard to do that living at Tassajara.
Yes.
It is pretty hard.
Yes.
Go do that. So we left. And I had been, you know, I had been living at Zen Center for 5 or 6 years and very sort of like very focused monastic practice. And I was in my 20s. The time, I was like, I didn't want to leave really, but okay, we'll leave. But as soon as I left, I was like in this big new world, right? And there was like all these things. I don't have this monastic container anymore. And one of the things that me and my partner started doing, you know, occasionally is we would buy some beer and drink it. And, you know, not like excessively, but, you know, maybe we'd even have more than one. It wasn't like we were like total wild partiers. But it became sort of right. We'd go shopping, which was also a new thing if you left Tassajara. We'd kind of maybe buy a six-pack each time. And meanwhile, I was regularly checking in with Tenzin Roshi. He didn't even ask me to do this, but I felt like very devoted to him as a teacher. Even though I'm kind of banished, I still want to like check in about my practice with you, like maybe once a month or something. I'd call him on the phone. And, you know, and I didn't have that much to, well, maybe I had quite a bit to confess. Like, I'm not so concentrated anymore. Or, like, I don't know about being out here, but I'm trying to maintain my practice and daily zazen and all of this. One time I mentioned, oh, by the way, for like 5 years, you know, I didn't drink anything at Tassajara now, or, you know, where sometimes we buy a six-pack of beer, and, you know, drink it. And his tone completely changed. And it was quite interesting that he, mostly he'd been very loving and supportive of my practice out in the world. But when I mentioned this, he said, I want you to not do that anymore, okay? Stop. Yeah, he was, and you know, it was quite interesting. I thought, isn't that kind of extreme? But maybe I should say it was maybe more than just one beer a week, right? It wasn't like getting really drunk, but it was like, you know, I think he might even ask. I said, we're buying like maybe like a six pack a week or something. He's like, I'd like to ask you to stop. And so this did not accord with my my wishes, with my what did it say? Doing something that will involve result in pain and unhappiness for the person. It wasn't extreme pain and unhappiness, but it was like, I'm not living in the monastery, and we're just out here. It's like, but because of my relationship with him, I was willing to stop. And, you know, I don't know if that was beneficial or not. And maybe if we, I mean, I'm the kind of person who I could have gone more and more into it over time, you know. We were out there, we had no sangha around us. We could have, my partner was a little bit of a wild and crazy woman. She would have had no hesitation, I think, to just, let's buy, you know, how about some whiskey now? And it could have just kept going that way, and like, this is just getting distracted from my practice that I'm trying to focus on. So it maybe was beneficial in the long run. And then, so that's, that was just, wasn't really involving a third party, but just, I mean, in a way, maybe it was involving a third party, actually. He was talking to me about this. She was a student of his, too, actually. So we might have been calling him together. We might have sometimes talked to him together, but this could be a third party issue. But he felt like it would be good for her, maybe even especially for her. Like, maybe like, Kokyo, you can, I think you might be able to handle this, but she maybe is going to get really involved in this, and like, to take care of her, why don't you both stop? But maybe he's saying it to me, right? And then another time, I was in another relationship. This was like a challenging thing for me in my years of practice and my teacher. This is where we'd sometimes have the most, where this precept maybe came most into accord, where mostly he'd be very supportive of me, but I would get really confused around intimate relationships. I know nobody else ever gets confused around it. But, and I think I didn't feel necessarily confused, but maybe he could tell you, you're not being as clear as usual in this situation. So there was another relationship that ended, and we kind of clearly ended it, and she left Zen Center. And but we would talk on the phone a lot, we were quite close, and it was a loving relationship, actually. But we're like, we're not going to be living together. We don't have this contract of commitment with each other. And it's like that. And I think then Tenshin Roshi would relate to me as a single priest in training at this point. And at one point, quite maybe some, like half a year or something after she left, and we were not together as a couple, she said, well, on your vacation, could you come visit? We're still quite close. And I thought that would be really nice, actually. She's like almost maybe my best friend still, actually, even though we've broken up. And so I ran this by the teacher. And he said, no, please don't go visit her on vacation. Oh, Roshi, she's like, you know, we're good friends. We've been together all this time. We're like, no, I think that it's going to make things really unclear. You know, if you go up there, it's going to confuse her. And even though you might think she's clear about this, and you even talked to her and she said, oh yeah, no, it's just a visit, it's like she might, without even knowing it, get like very attached, and then, you know, say, why don't you just stay up here, why don't you come back every week or whatever. And so again, it was a third party issue. He was actually saying it more for her in that case, and he told me this. So that's all these permutations, and they come up. And that one was one where I felt like I was disappointed. I really wanted to visit. And, you know, maybe after like a year or so of feeling that, I came to see his wisdom and thought, yeah, actually, it would have been really messy. It would have been really, like, it would have made this whole situation very unclear. And he had great wisdom, and he was very strong about this. He was like, no, we're not even going to discuss it. Please don't. I tried to discuss it. I tried to negotiate. He was very firm about this. And I think he's a wonderful teacher who's practiced with many, many students over many, many years. And that's partly why from his own experience, he's seen a lot of confused, difficult situations. So he's like, I want to take care of you. Please keep this really clear. And I want to take care of her too. So that's this whole section without reading all the language. It's all these things about something that might not be pleasing or happy to the student or the person the bodhisattva is relating with, but to not complying, not according with their expectation. So this is the section that qualifying what it means that the bodhisattva accords with others' expectations. He says, well, here's the cases where you don't. If it doesn't benefit them, or if it would harm them in the long term, or harm another party that's related somehow. So going down to, say, like the third paragraph. Furthermore, the bodhisattva who complies with the expectations of others will approach and greet someone else even when not approached. I thought, I don't know how you all are with this, but I think a lot of people who come to Zen practice are introverts. Maybe you're not. Maybe Kathy's not.
I'm known for not being an introvert. But I'm also... not in the majority. But I have my introversion. Just not when I'm...
And maybe some of us are, you know, kind of midway. I think due to practice, I consider myself, when I was younger, to be very shy and introverted. And as time goes on in the practice, it balances us more, I think, in both ways.
Yeah.
I think for introverts... that this, like, actually approaching people to greet them is, like, going out of your way is, like, not a instinctual thing. Like, you know, if somebody says hi, I'll say hi, but, like, my nature is not the type to, like, go up to people, like, in a crowd and say, hey, how you doing?
I mean, do it now.
But now I kind of have this job, right, this role where I feel like, it's this bodhisattva precept, actually. So I do actually here try to do that in this situation with new people. Yeah. But like down at the farmer's market or downtown or something, actually I rarely do because I'm out of my role, I think. So, but you could say bodhisattva is always in role. You're always, you know, especially maybe if someone's looking down and out. And occasionally, with like homeless people, some people that look really down and out, maybe I'll approach them. But I think it's a hard one for me. You could say, what then to say when she has been approached and greeted? Well, that's not so hard. Or is that song saying, well, obviously when you're approached and greeted, of course you respond with greeting. But the bodhisattva does this extra step of approaching others. Actually, the English translation that I reworked a lot of it just going through this. The original said, accost. A bodhisattva accosts people and greets them. And I thought, I even looked it up and said, accost means to like aggressively approach. I thought, well, that's not quite the right word. The bodhisattva who complies or accords with the expectations of others does not cause others to be upset. He only desires to rebuke them out of mercy, rebuking them with calm faculties.
Is that the right word?
Rebuke?
Well, a rebuke and approach are really, I mean, rebuke, isn't that you're actually wanting to correct something?
Yeah, I think we're in another part now where he's saying,
yes.
Yeah, in this case, it's not just greeting now, it's rebuking.
Rebuke is too strong. That's just not correct.
Maybe like...
Because that's a really aggressive...
Maybe to admonish...
Out of mercy.
Well, it could be a valid thing to do, even as a bodhisattva, but it seems like it's a little bit... there's no preface.
Yeah. Well, he's going into another section. But what would be a word that we could use that would mean like...
Correct.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah. Adjust.
Yeah, adjust. Adjust, yeah. So like when Tenzin Roshi would say like, hey, I want you to stop this now. Is it, I could call it a rebuke. I could hear it as a rebuke.
Rebuke would be, oh no, you mustn't. Correct would be, don't. I want you to stop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's how he started with, I want you to, rather than don't, right?
Yeah, I don't remember the words, but maybe that would be a good way to say it, I want you to, and you have, and I know that our relationship is such that what I want matters to you.
Yeah.
That's the difficult thing about this teacher-student thing. Yeah,
it's
correct.
Work, though, because it's the relationship.
Yeah.
That's
different, yeah.
Versus if it was a complete stranger who was sitting in Dokusan.
Yeah.
You might say, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's very true, yeah. Like it says at the beginning of this section, it's all about context. The bodhisattva first knows the inclinations and natures of these beings and then responds. If somebody's really, always feeling... I mean, this is an issue because we have this in the practice world, people who are very sensitive to critique. Actually, all of us are, I think, but some people are like the slightest hint at a correction. Some people get really upset, some more than others. I think those people, then the bodhisattva has to be very gentle and careful. And maybe they don't. There's some ways that they might help others who are more open to that, but they maybe just actually can't help in these certain ways, those people, right? Because they'll just get too upset. I think this is true.
Yeah, that's coming up with that appropriate response to whatever.
Yeah, so that's part of like, as a student, then is part of like, if we want this more sort of advanced kind of training, we might have to like train ourselves first to like be really able to like receive correction, which is, for me, it's quite hard, actually. And I might have gotten more correction, which valuable training if it wasn't so hard, if I didn't kind of like defend myself when my teacher would say various things.
It's interesting. Well, I was just going to say, I'm sorry, I read forward one sentence because I was curious about the words here. And it's interesting that the language feels akin to what my experience has been. It says, when someone has already been punished and humbled, he does not accuse him first.
Oh, yes.
And so it's kind of like when you're making this assessment of a person's state, people who carry around a lot of shame, who've already been punished and humbled, like by their life, would be less able to have it be helpful.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than maybe somebody who's got maybe a little stronger ego.
Yeah.
Hasn't had so much of an experience of being punished and humbled in their life. That might be one of the...
That's very true.
...to be sensitive to in others.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So this bodhisattva thing is very challenging, to be so sensitive, so aware, so watching the situation move, constantly making mistakes and readjusting ourselves. Oh, how wonderful to try. One mistake after another?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Somebody asked Dogen to sum up his life, and that's what he said.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
One mistake after another.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. That's the bodhisattva's path.
Do you think it's just like in a monastic training situation, the lines of attachment are clearer with the teacher? And I wonder kind of out in this world of practice, it's even more complicated.
I think so. Great point.
To have a student, and to ask them to
Yeah. I think it is. Yeah. Yeah.
That's, of course, what, I mean, but I think when, like, Zen came to this country with Shunryu Suzuki, and then after his death, Richard Baker and the whole shoes outside the door thing, where lots of people knew about that, but for whatever reason didn't want to bring that up because they didn't want to, whatever, shake the boat. And then, of course, there was a big opinion. Mm-hmm. A lot of people left.
Yeah.
That's because the whole thing was in transition and trying to find an American form where.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're still struggling with it. Maybe not quite as dramatic. Mm-hmm. I think,
how does it work in this culture?
Yeah,
and that's a great question, is how does it work outside of that container where those relationships are so, it's almost like, it becomes more like a family relationship because you're all living together, right? Mm-hmm. So everything becomes that much more, nothing's hidden. Yeah, and everything affects everything else. So the third party is always there. The many parties around are being affected. And,
this is true also for the Catholic faith. For all many centuries, child abuse was, and now it's really coming out in the open. But that's sort of, even on an ongoing, continuous tradition, it's happening. Mm-hmm. It happened not just here in America, but all throughout the world in Catholic.
And there's the thing about, and there's fear of correcting and admonishing. Maybe in that case, and maybe this was, I don't know about shoes outside the door, but I think maybe more in the Catholic Church, it might be to protect the institution of the Church, right?
Yeah.
It's like, if we bring this out, it's going to, like, everyone's going to leave. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And didn't it happen mostly in the parishes, in the communities, rather than in the monasteries?
Yeah. Well, there weren't kids in the monasteries. Well, maybe there were some.
They were just having consensual sex in the
monasteries. It's something else. But I think, mostly it's like, the parish churches. Yeah. So the Bodhisattva, even if they're correcting, they don't ridicule or become sarcastic and intimidating. That's a tricky one where because sometimes the personality is a little bit this way. And, again, my teacher has that kind of, he can do this kind of like, kind of playful teasing thing, and some people can get quite hurt by it.
Yeah.
And but I think he checks it out. He tries probing with some teasing. It keeps it a little bit lighthearted, but then if people get really like have a problem, then he can shift it. Maybe nice. I mean, sometimes maybe sarcasm may be never quite helpful, but like being kind of like making it a little lighthearted somehow could be skillful way to correct someone or not, right? Depending on the situation, but not sarcastic and intimidating doesn't make someone regret not putting her at ease. That's a good one. Like if somebody like disturbs me and then like great, they're like ruined my day, not to come back with a little bit of like and you such and such. Especially hard in a more like teacher role, right? Is because if there's some authority there, it could easily be used to diminish others. If we're feeling personally hurt, mm-hmm. it could be put back on a student, for example, and it's so dangerous, it's so challenging, right? But because bodhisattvas can get triggered. when someone's been punished and humbled, does not accuse him further. Kathy mentioned, it's like you make the point and you don't have to keep rubbing it in or bringing it up the next time. She doesn't show herself to be grand before those who are downcast. Bodhisattva who complies with expectations of others does not fail to cultivate, or I think we could say train others, nor does he train others excessively, nor unseasonably, like at the wrong time, offer some correction at the wrong time or too much, doesn't censure someone before her friends, nor praise her before her foes, I think that's another good one.
Not speaking bad words about people.
This is saying doesn't. It's a little. I actually did question that. Well, what's wrong with praising someone before their enemies? Like they're not. They're a pretty good person. So I don't know about that. It's just like the reversal. But definitely the thing of not admonishing someone in front of their friends or in front of other people in general is a good one, because if it's privately people, but it might be embarrassing if there's a whole group. This comes up a lot in Zen communities, I think.
He does not beg continually.
Oh, yeah. He knows the proper measure to be taken and does not ignore an invitation to food, drink, and the like, or excuses himself in the right way. I mentioned this the other day, that it's mentioned in other Bodhisattva collections of if you're invited to dinner or something, you have to accept. Because it's like according, well, it's more like you're receiving the invitation. Mm-hmm. And because it gives people an opportunity to practice giving. Mm-hmm. So, and then that one commentary said, you don't always, if everything people invite you, you don't have to always go to everything. You can excuse yourself with gratitude. Say, thank you very much for asking, but I have another practice commitment, as the commentary said.
Right.
Not like, I want to just go home and do my own thing, but like, I have to sit zazen now, so I can't go to dinner.
With my computer. Looking at, fast forwarding through YouTube.
Yeah, that's right.
The white
part? Yes. So great. These things are so, do come up, don't they? I thought, is it this section? I was looking for something else here, but I just before the class, and I just happened to find this about, I think it kind of applies to this section by Suzuki Roshi, because it's a chapter in Not Always So called Observing the Precepts, but he says, in the scriptures, 5 points are made about how to be careful. It's almost like, I don't know what scripture, but sounds like a little bit like a sangha. One, this is about teachers being careful with students, especially. One is that the teacher has to choose his opportunity and not point out the student's mistake in front of many people. If possible, the teacher points out the mistake personally in an appropriate time and place. Secondly, the teacher is reminded to be truthful, which means the teacher does not point out his disciple's mistake just because he thinks it's a mistake. When the teacher understands why the disciple did so, then he can be truthful.
Yeah.
That's nice, not just like...
understanding a person's... What was going
on? Yeah.
The whole context.
Which is tricky around things like forms and precepts, because you might say, well, this is just our way. It doesn't matter why you did it. That's the precept. But he's being more nuanced and saying, actually, I see that... In this case, they went against maybe a precept, but it seemed maybe not so, as we'll hear later in this text, bodhisattvas can break precepts. This is a radical part.
Yeah.
Even break like the major precepts. But in this case, it would be like he sees where they're coming from. They actually were like coming from an unwholesome, distracted mind or something, harmful place. The third reminder is for the teacher to be gentle and calm and speak in a low voice rather than shouting. This is something very delicate, like truthfulness, but here the scripture puts emphasis on having a calm, gentle attitude when talking about someone's mistake. Mm-hmm. The fourth one is that the teacher gives advice or points out the disciple's mistake solely for the sake of helping him and does not do this just to get something off his chest. That's a good one. Like sometimes, it might even be like, well, like sometimes I think of like with forms, right? Just minor things, right? Correcting forms. It's like, oh, watch this in service. And if I don't say something right now, I'm going to completely forget about it. within the next few minutes. But like actually, that person's talking with somebody else right now at Soji or whatever. This happens all the time in my world. And like, should I kind of interrupt them? Or they look like they're in a hurry and they have to leave right away. That happens a lot too here. I think we're gonna miss this one. Mm-hmm. Actually, mm-hmm. It's not appropriate right now to stop them just to like correct them on this form. Mm-hmm. But if they're hanging around or talking later and they're just not in a hurry. Oh, by the way, you know when you bow there, so.
We could give you permission right now.
Well,
you could send an email later or something.
Okay. You can.
Not to miss the opportunity.
You can. Yeah, around form things. I feel some permission to like mention form things, you know, mm-hmm. to people. I think again it's part of my role. Mm-hmm. And some people ask more explicitly. And again, Tenzin Roshi's got where a lot we would talk about giving feedback in this challenging arena of giving and receiving feedback. And one time he said, to maybe a general group. He said this is numerous times, but he's like, I try not to give feedback unless I feel really invited to give it. And people would say, I think someone even said, well, you know, if we're like your student, like we receive the precepts from you, and maybe even like we're priest ordained by you, then that means that you have our permission, right? And he says, well, a little bit more maybe, but even then, it's like if you haven't explicitly said that, because I've done it a lot in the past and it didn't work so well, I try not to do it. Or if I feel like there's a relationship with someone where they might want to hear this and we might have that kind of, there might be that invitation, then I maybe ask, would you like some feedback? And if they say, it kind of gets, and you've done this to me many times, and I feel it's very helpful to me. Because if it just comes unexpectedly, and I'm not ready, then I just sometimes instinctually just go into like the defensive mind. But if he asks, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's a practice I'm working on with him. It might be hard, but like, he's gotten me ready, and I'm ready to receive some, so I'm not just going to jump into my defense.
Like,
yeah, it really works.
Preface.
Yeah, would you like some? And he said, I guess some people have said to him, yes, but not now. I'm having a hard morning.
Yeah.
Check with me tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I'll do that. If I remember.
Just so you know, if I might raise my own individual thing, I always want feedback. When I hear, would you like some feedback? I don't like that.
Lay on.
I always want the training.
Uh-huh.
And plus, for years, I heard around city centers, can I give you some feedback about that?
Do you think because it makes it too big a thing? Or why wouldn't we like it?
It was just culturally tedious.
It was culturally tedious. That's exactly right. Right. It was a way to be caring that didn't always feel
PC,
caring.
Maybe.
Yeah. Mm. It was more like, I am about to give you feedback, but I'm going to ask you first just because it's polite to ask you.
And if you're a good Zen student, you'll always say yes, right?
So
you're going to get it anyway.
It's all scripted.
It's scripted.
Well,
yeah.
I had the experience.
I could see that.
People really reacting, seeing people really be very defensive, where they I think they would be if they're prepared and they feel like they have some choice, then they don't necessarily have to have that defensive reaction.
Well, here's an example. The Bodhisattva knows the inclinations, right? So they say, Dana, I'll just give it directly. With Kathy, I'm going to ask. That's another hard part.
Well, I think you pay attention to, you know, how others respond, and then you kind of learn.
Yeah.
Where, you know, which
people are. Yeah. Yeah.
Trial and
humbled
error.
And, you know, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. Punished and humbled, and, you know. Get out your spreadsheet. Put it on your app coming out.
So the Finnish Suzuki Roshi's five points about how to be careful. This fourth one is about not saying something just to get it off your chest. Here the teacher is very careful, noticing when the student is making some excuse for what he did or when the student's not serious enough. Then the teacher should ignore him until he becomes more serious.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Even though we give advice only for the sake of helping the student, still this does not mean to always be easy with the student. Sometimes we should be very tough with the student, or we cannot help in a true sense. The last point is to point out the student's mistake with compassion, which means that the teacher is not just the teacher, but also the disciple's friend. Mm. As a friend, the teacher points out some problem or gives some advice. So it's not easy to be a teacher or to be a student, and we cannot rely on anything, even the precepts. We have to make our utmost effort to help each other. And we do not observe our precepts just for the sake of precepts or practice rituals for the perfection of rituals. We're studying how to express our true nature. Yeah. Makes me wonder, like, all the nuances of how he practiced with those crazy young Americans.
I'm surprised he knew the idiom, getting something off your chest.
Yeah. I think he used. Unless it was edited. Such. So, the ninth aspect of embracing and sustaining all beings is a bodhisattva with the ethics of applauding genuine good qualities, applauds sentient beings. You could say maybe praises their good.
Applauding?
Well, I think just praising their good qualities. Also, I think of mudita, sympathetic joy. And particularly, you know, then he says these good qualities like faith, morality, learnedness, renunciation, wisdom. The bodhisattva applauds. Oh, yes, that's great when you practice that way. The tenth practice is aspect of benefiting beings is the bodhisattva with the ethics of suppression. Puts a stop to harmful sentient beings. Minor faults and minor transgressions, she rebukes or corrects with mild correction. Her attitude gentle and free of bad feeling. Medium faults and transgressions, he corrects with medium correction. And major is corrected with major. Acts of punishment should be understood by analogy with rebuke. So this whole, more of the same of this area, that's a little scary to even hear about this kind of thing, right? Even hear about banishing, with the thought of mercy and the thought of benefit, to banish people for a certain period of time in order to subsequently regain them or bring them back again. Sometimes even banishing them permanently, though, which is hard to imagine. But you could say, if someone's really, this is referring to like in the monastic order, if someone really doesn't want to practice like that, then you say, well, don't keep practicing this way, where people are going to get confused about what the practice is here. We'll banish you just from the monastery here or something. And, you know, people have been, I think Hannah brought up before, at Green Goats, and people have been lovingly banished. Sometimes not always lovingly, but I think the person you were talking about, as a student of Tenshin Roshi again, and I think he, with some pain, because he was a very devoted student, after making several mistakes in certain ways, I felt like, okay, he's, for his practice, I hope he'll come back, but I think it's time for some banishment. And as I told you, I was in a way sort of banished for a while, right, getting into this relationship with the thought I would come back. I didn't really feel it as banishment, but it could be seen like, go away for a while. We have, there's some of the Zen koans have those stories, right? go away for a while. You're too noisy, go away for a while. Or like, you stole the community's noodles to make a nice meal without asking permission. You're going to have to leave now. You know, we have these are stories. The Tenzo banishment story. We have Dogen praises both the banished and the banisher. And I took out 11 before I realized how these were all numbered. There was another paragraph that I, just because it was so far out, and to save space. Well, there's a lot, this is about a third of the whole text. So that one was about miraculous powers. The Bodhisattva,
number 11,
the desire to frighten sentient beings and bend them to her will by the power of working wonders. Yeah, like
bend
cities.
Bend people to your will with the power of working wonders.
Of miracles. Yeah. It's in, you know, this is an elaboration, so it's at the bottom of page 2. The bottom of page 2. Or no, the top of page 2 in the first paragraph, with wonder-working power, she makes manifest hell and other places by which she alarms them into their unwholesomeness, bending them to her will, pleasing them, surprising them in order to introduce them to Buddha's teaching. And it says, manifesting as Vajrapani or wrathful deities, and hell. I think Dogen actually has a story, which I didn't bring, but you could look up. I think it's in the Chiji Shingi, the guidelines for the officers. At the beginning of that, it's in, I think it's in Enlightenment Unfolds. Dogen tells this long story about the Buddha, I think, carrying someone to hell realms and heavenly realms to teach them about their intentions. So you can check that out. But, you know, we don't talk about this so much. I thought, and how do you have to have miraculous powers to be able to do this. But I think it's not just for negative, not just to scare them with hell, but also it says to please them, to create, to build up their faith. And so like Tibetan Buddhist tradition really does get into emphasizing the miraculous. And my understanding is that it's for, in that culture, that's how you build people's faith. We say, for us, it would probably diminish people's faith in America. They're like, you're just crazy. Your religion's crazy. But in that culture where they already had all these spirits and demons and invisible beings, it's like then, and magic, it was a culture of magic. So then, if Buddhism can like do some magic, then the people will be like, oh, cool. Then there's something going on here. And for me, because it's now in American Tibetan Buddhist culture, a lot of, you know, there's emphasis on a lot of these stories we don't get into in Zen. It makes me wonder about it. And sometimes I feel like, well, that, you know, what really encourages me is the practice and the practitioners and their, you know, and their kindness and compassion and concentration and those things. But I think if I were to understand it, maybe it would have some impact on me when it's like there's things like the deeper aspects of practice where there's more going on in this universe than meets our eyes, right? Is this some Shakespeare quote?
Shakespeare. There are more things under heaven and earth than are dreamed of in your philosophy, Horatio.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
dreamed of in your philosophy.
So, like, to hear, oh, no, if you, you know, if you supplicate some bodhisattvas, if you really devotedly praise and make offering and connect with Avalokiteshvara, maybe she'll come and meet you, like in a vision, and how being Dharma protectors, right? We have in our tradition, they're like, you know, do they actually influence? Are there actually beings that are influencing things. And sometimes we might get little signs or we hear stories about these things, and it could be encouraging to even someone like me that who's pretty rational, I think, that like, oh, there's like, I just have no, I'm just seeing this tiny little tip of the Dharma iceberg here, the conscious world. And there's this whole, like we're surrounded maybe by all kinds of energetic influences and entities that are like causing effects. And sometimes the effects manifest through our intentions. And that can increase our faith and like, oh, I want to go deeper. I want to deepen my understanding and practice.
My mom, and this is true throughout her life, was psychic. We could never lose anything in the house. She would simply make her mind a blank, see where it was, and go get it. And we lived in a big house with attic, cellar, everything. Nothing was ever lost. And then she related she was scared to death when she was visited, according to her mom, by her guardian angel when she was really young. It was a relative that had died. And oh, that's just your guardian angel. So, I mean, I grew up with that and saw it in action, so no problem for me because I grew up with it. You know?
She could be very helpful. We can, a lot of us could use her.
She just naturally had it. I mean, it's not, she didn't have to work for it. It was there, born with it. The souls could just wipe out and find whatever.
In the 70s, a friend of mine took a meditation class where there was a goal in the class to levitate.
Right. Oh, TM.
And, TM?
Advanced TM.
Yeah. And they would you know, talk about, you know, I think I levitate.
Just a little bit. Just like a millimeter.
Cobb Mountain, I had a friend who was into that.
Wow.
We'd love to Cobb Mountain and do bouncing.
I think if it's a skillful means to increase faith in the true practice, that's one thing. If it becomes an end in itself, then we kind of miss the point, right? So, skillful means. So, that's the end of the long section on the Bodhisattva's embracing and sustaining all beings. Then, there's a little space here, and then there's another section about the ceremony.
What page are you on now?
At the bottom of four.
Yes.
So these three pure bodhisattva precepts is a measureless collection of merit. The bodhisattva, whether lay or monastic, who aspires to train in these three collective precepts, that is the bodhisattva training, who has made the resolve for unsurpassed, complete, perfect awakening, should first prostrate to a bodhisattva who has also made the bodhisattva resolve, who's received and knows the vow, and who's capable of understanding its meaning, and then entreat him as follows. So, an interesting point is that before receiving these bodhisattva precepts, here the bodhisattva should have already made this resolve for complete, perfect awakening. So, like bodhicitta, they already have bodhicitta wish. And one commentary says, in other words, they want to practice wholeheartedly and practice Buddha's way. That's why they want to receive the precepts, not based on instigation from another person. Like somebody says, so these are all things that could happen, right, in our modern life. Somebody could say, you know, you should really receive the precepts. You've been practicing a long time, why don't you do it? And they feel kind of like coerced into it. Yeah, I guess maybe I should. It's like they shouldn't receive them for that reason. Also against their will, that's similar, instigation from others, or against their own will, or out of competition or pride. So like, well, everybody receives the precepts, I should do it too, to keep up with the precept Joneses. So it should be coming from this bodhisattva resolve. Maybe, you know, if there's other things that are already mixed in there, somebody tries to coerce us also, oh, okay, as long as we have this this wish. So then one of the commentaries says this bowing to a bodhisattva who's received them. So this is what we do in our ceremonies, right? the ordinees come and they do prostrations to the preceptors. And one old commentary says about this prostration, they say, without reverence, the vow will not be created. That's a nice way of putting it. Somebody said, why are we doing prostrations to this person? Without reverence for bodhisattva practice, the vow actually won't work. You have to do a lot of prostrations to create a feeling of reverence. And the commentary also says, and you offer incense and can request the vow. And so we have these parts in our ceremonies. Tenshin Roshi likes to actually, there's a little part where people come up and offer incense at the beginning, and he adds in the oral commentary that says, I see by your incense offering that you're requesting the precepts, to make it really clear that, like, you have to really make sure that you're requesting them, and that you're not just, oh, I just showed up in the room and somebody's giving me this. And the commentary said, the teacher should be practicing the six paramitas, not necessarily perfectly. But they shouldn't be too stingy, unethical, angry, lazy, unconcentrated, or deluded. It's okay with it a little bit, though. And then, this is a commentary. Oh, also, there's an interesting part here that I didn't include the longer part in the original text, and also in other Bodhisattva precepts texts, like the book Ramajala Sutra, they say, if you can't find a teacher to give you these precepts, you can do it without a teacher. And you do it by, like, setting up images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and prostrating before them and kind of visualizing them as the teacher and, you know, making the vow. So it's kind of a radical thing. And but then the commentaries, there was some extensive commentary about this, even old one, where they say, what does this mean if they can't find a teacher? So it means that, like, they, you know, it's okay to travel afar. It's like, if there's nobody in my town, that doesn't count. It's okay, you still have to travel. But if the traveling to find a teacher who can give you bodhisattva precepts, if the traveling will endanger your life or your vows, your other vows, in some way, then you're permitted to do it at home. So maybe, like, if your town is, like, surrounded by wild lions and tigers, and there's a bodhisattva in the next town who could do this, but, like, you'll probably die on the road, or you have to fly to another country, but all the planes are crashing. Something. So I think about this, you know, because in modern times, if some people are doing online ordination, Skype ordinations, right? Like video, even priest ordinations in Soto Zen, like with multiple people in multiple countries at the same time. And it's quite controversial in the American Soto Zen world. There's been a lot of discussions, like, is that legitimate or not? And the preceptors doing it are saying, yeah, we're not, like, from this kind of big Mahayana perspective, it's like, well, time and space are just like illusions, you know? And, like, we're actually are meeting face to face. We're using technology. We're just not physically there, but physically is not the main thing. So that's his perspective. And then I think a more traditional Zen teachers are saying, when, you know, they should make an effort to go there, especially for a priest ordination, or find someone closer. And I tend to fall into that side myself. I'm like, well, you know, what's wrong with making the effort? Because if you really can't afford it or something, well, there's probably some place where you could. So
much is intention, it seems to me. If the intention is really powerful,
mm-hmm.
then you can transcend some of these other things.
Yeah.
You know, Ed had a student who was dying.
Mm.
And I took to Ireland, since I was going, the things for him to make a rock soup. And I took my old blue rakusu in case he couldn't make one. And then we decided Ingen could go with me and we could, you know, Brown Rope could do it. And then he was too sick. He was afraid we would go out there and he wouldn't be conscious, which I thought was fine, but he didn't think was fine. So we just decided over the phone that since his intention was so strong that it was true anyway.
Oh. Well, did he do something with Ed on the phone? Or
just he did something with Ed on the phone, I'm sure.
Because they could, you know, you could do a recite the refuges and precepts on the phone.
The whole phone thing was extremely difficult because he was in a nursing home and on the phone.
Yeah, so that's a good example of like really sick. There may be cases where, and you can't, you really want to, it's before dying. But I think this is an example of, there was some feeling like, we want to actually have a face-to-face personal thing. So even if it's not Ed, Ingen's going to come as a living person and do this. Mm-hmm. So we have some feeling about that.
And I wish so much, I still wish so much, he let me go. You know, the man had let me go. That he told me where this nursing home was. Mm. And that even if he wasn't conscious, I would just put my rakusu on him. Mm. And he would wake up and he would, you know, but it didn't happen.
Well, you know, also in Soto Zen, we do posthumous ordinations. You know, after someone's died, they can still receive the precepts. So we do it like a funeral, it's part of a funeral ceremony, often to receive precepts. And I was reading about how they, even these giant Jukai ceremonies that they do at like a Heiji, they have people come, there's hundreds of people, and they come in these sections, so that everyone receives the precepts again and again. So like the priests who've already received them go and receive them, lay people go, and then they have this whole like group for deceased people, and they like, I think they maybe have cards of paper with their names or something, but they go up onto a precept platform and receive them, like a whole bunch of people even, so after they've died. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's never too late.
It's never too late.
A friend of mine recently died, and at his memorial, a Jodo Shinshu priest got up and said, "This is his Dharma name."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're often given a name at that time if they have Dharma name.
Do you like a Jukai?
No, I don't think so. They just. And I'm not even sure the priest was allowed in this guy's room, but she gave him a name afterwards.
Yeah, so bodhisattvas, with a great intention, try to find a living person to give them, and if they can't, they can't. So it's about the time. So they just say, to close here, "I wish to receive from you, child of good family, the bodhisattva precepts, discipline, and commitment. If it's no trouble for you, may you hear me and grant this out of compassion." So, child of good family, Kulaputra is this term that I think it means, not necessarily like you had your parents were good people, but I think it means like the bodhisattva family. You're a child of the Mahayana lineage. Yeah, one commentary does say that. Yeah. Yeah, yep, exactly. Exactly. He's saying even before, you already have this bodhicitta intention, so now you're going to come and do this. And then in the ceremony they say, Will you receive these precepts? We can finish it next week, but the ceremony basically consists of the preceptor just saying, "Will you now receive these three pure precepts?" Which we say in ours, but they say it three times, and that's the end of the ceremony. That's like, they don't actually like list them. They just, "Will you receive them? Yes, I will. Will you receive them? Yes, I will. Will you receive them? Yes, I will." You've received them. So, I think a lot of these elements from, you know, maybe even going to this particular Asanga text in our ceremonies, you know, go back to these points. It's a lot of like repetition. Now will you receive the 10 great precepts? Yes, I will.
Sure.
Are you sure? Thank you for coming together to study these old Bodhisattva practices, and maybe some of them, some of these practices come up in various situations. If we remember them, and like, am I saying this just to get it off my chest,
yeah,
or whatever? So many details, right? May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.